Kia ora, I'm Anne Hassan. Welcome to the Tui Motu podcast, the podcast from Tui Motu magazine, New Zealand's only independent Catholic magazine. This month I spoke to Kevin Clements. Kevin is the director of the Tauda Peace Institute and was the founding professor of the National Centre for Peace and Conflict Studies at Otago University. Kevin has spent a lifetime working in the areas of peace and social justice. I started by asking Kevin what first inspired him to start working in this area.
Well, I mean, I think I have to go back to my parents. My father was a pacifist and a conscientious objector and spent, you know, the Second World War in detention camp. And I was born in Opotiki, where the Returned Servicemen's Association decided that they didn't want to have a conscientious objector Methodist minister. And so organised a boycott against my family, and the entire town refused to provide us with any food or clothing or anything else. And we were saved by a Methodist parishioner who was a former RAF pilot, who said, you know, you didn't fight the war in order to maintain prejudice and bigotry at home. So I suppose that was the sort of backdrop. I mean, when I was old enough, I was very keen to understand why my father was willing to spend 3 years in detention, even though he often wondered whether that was the right decision, you know, as he heard more and more about how desperate everything was in Germany. But that was probably the beginning of it, and he had a very strong Methodist social gospel. I mean, he wasn't an evangelical by any means, but he was very much committed to, you know, realising the kingdom of heaven on earth and in earth, and all the things he did. So that was the beginning. And then when I was at high school, I was not a very good conformist in my high school. So I joined forces with Paul Melser, who's a potter now and wire wrapper. And we used to wear duffel coats instead of the ordinary school uniform to school. And we didn't wear garters. And we were constantly kind of making a stand for justice in the school.
Through the duffel coat.
Through the duffel coat and through, yeah, not wearing caps and all the other silly things we were asked to do. And then we both channeled ourselves into the youth campaign for nuclear disarmament. And I guess that's where I started getting very conscious about, you know, nuclear issues, the imminent destruction of the entire world. And
that was the first issue that really animated it for you.
That was the first thing, yes, because in the 1960s, which was a little bit before your time, we could actually see the flash from the Bikini hydrogen bomb tests, and then strontium 90 levels rose in all of New Zealand's milk and things like that. So it was a very sort of real and present danger, and so the British testing occurred, the American testing kept on, and then the French testing occurred. So most of my youth was spent trying to figure out how we could oppose nuclear weapons, and one of my biggest desires when I was young was to go to London and join Bertrand Russell and be arrested with the Committee of 100. My father said I could do that as long as I, you know, got a degree first of all. So I got a degree first of all, and never got arrested with Bertrand Russell. Yeah.
And you got your degree in?
In sociology and political science, and then a PhD in sociology. And that again was, you know, on churches and social policy, looking at the role of religious ideology in the formation of the welfare state. So it was looking at the impact of social justice traditions. I mean, the Catholic Church and the Methodist Church, I think, were exemplary in relation to making sure that their gospels had some practical impact.
Mm.
So that was, you know, so that was, you know, how I started. And then during that time in the 60s, of course, we were sidetracked by the war in Vietnam, and so I was a very active member of the Committee on Vietnam in Wellington, and we were constantly protesting at, you know, the visits of, you know, President Johnson and Prime Minister Ky from Vietnam. But, you know, that was a sort of time of political ferment, and again that sort of sharpened my sort of consciousness of the way in which the world was sort of very sharply divided into those who had power and those who didn't, and so forth.
Yeah. And do you think that experience of being shunned as a family in Opotiki, do you think that gave you a sense of fellow feeling with...
Yes, it did, because, you know, I suddenly realised, yeah, all of the causes I've been involved in have kind of been minority causes. Mm. I mean, except for the anti-nuclear one, which became a majority cause. But in a way, I suppose, yeah, my father used to say that, you know, if it was worth doing and it was a cause worth promoting, I mean, you know, you wouldn't be gaining friends by it. And actually, New Zealand in the 1960s, I mean, the security intelligence services and the police and others were very opposed to, you know, all of the oppositional movements that were forming. And so we were a minority and a stigmatised minority. I mean, the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament and the Committee on Vietnam were roundly chastised by Holyoake and Marshall and others as, you know, dangerous left-wing movements that would deliver New Zealand to the communists.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, so that whole idea about, you know, daring to be a Daniel and daring to stand alone and all that kind of stuff, that was part of... you know, my background, and I think that, you know, did really shape and make me conscious of the fact that, you know, you couldn't live comfortably if other people were uncomfortable.
Mm. Mm. And nuclear disarmament, which was the left's great victory.
Yes.
How do you feel now that that is...
under attack?
Yeah.
Well... absolutely. I mean, you know, in the 1980s, when the whole world was, the whole of New Zealand was turning themselves nuclear free and putting, you know, nuclear free zones on stickers and houses and so forth. I mean, that was a sort of a high point of the peace movement in New Zealand, and its success is gauged by the fact that, you know, all successive governments have maintained that policy, although it's really under threat right now.
But it was a source of great national pride for so long.
National pride, and it was part of our national identity that we were nuclear free. But even then, I was, you know, after the legislation, I was very conscious of the fact that there were sort of all sorts of forces that were lined up against the stand. I mean, so, you know, the then American ambassador, for example, Paul Cleveland, he was very, very upset that New Zealand had taken that position and was doing all he could from where he stood in the embassy to make sure that it was undermined and challenged.
Now, we're in a time where nuclear disarmament is being challenged. We're in a time where we've got conflict in Africa, in Europe, in the Middle East, when East Asia is increasingly unsettled.
Yeah.
So... how do you maintain an attitude of progress and hope for peace when it seems so fractured globally?
Yeah, this is not a good time to be a peacenik. And it makes you sort of feel that all of the small achievements that were made in the 70s, 80s, 90s and the early 2000s, you know, when we were genuinely optimistic about building a rules-based order and peaceful relationships between countries and so forth, you know, that was a sort of a moment, I think, when, you know, when it looked as though we were making real progress. And I think that gave everybody a sort of a fillip and generated a lot of optimism and enthusiasm for maintaining the anti-nuclear stand. I mean, at that time, I was appointed to the New Zealand Defence Committee of Inquiry as the sort of peacenik on the committee to... try and figure out how New Zealand could defend itself in a non-nuclear fashion and with a minimal amount of military. And that was an interesting experience, although a lot of people didn't think that my role on it was, you know, in the end, was as radical as it might have been. But it was still, nevertheless, a chance to think afresh about how do we defend ourselves and what did we have to fear. And what was the role of entangling alliances and things. And I think from that moment onwards, New Zealand, I think, really made a fetish out of being anti-nuclear.
Mm.
But getting back to your question, I think, you know, we have choices to make. I mean, you either are in favour of Eros and life forces and love and compassion and making sure that your relationships are right, or you're in favour of Thanatos and death and very bleak and dark things. And I mean, look at a lot of the leadership around the world at the moment. You know, it looks as though Thanatos is in the ascendancy, that, you know, we've swung, you know, behind leaders, or not me, but others have swung behind leaders who have a vested interest in realpolitik and power politics and force and coercion and making sure that the top dog is the right dog and domination is the desired position to be in. And I think that's extremely challenging for all of us that are interested in community and in compassion and compassionate politics.
Mm. When you say compassionate politics, lots of people are going to think that sounds flaky.
Yes.
That, as an opposition to all this power and domination, compassion sounds feeble. So what do you mean when you say compassion?
I mean a politics which is where power is with others rather than over others, where there is a kind of a focus on building just and sustainable communities. In the past, I think you could have talked about the New Zealand welfare state as a good example of compassionate politics. When we think about, you know, womb-to-tomb security that the Labour government gave us in 1935, I think that was pretty close. Mm-hmm. And all of the Scandinavian welfare politics, you know, which themselves are under challenge, I think are other good examples of the way in which governments can play an active role in ensuring that kind of security and welfare. And I think those political systems are good examples of compassionate politics. And I think we're a long way away from that at the moment. And in terms of our current coalition government, I mean, there's no manifest interest in welfare and in compassion and in doing things which are good and which really serve the needs and interests of others. And so, when we're confronted by the politics of greed, the politics of fear, the politics of ruthlessness, you know, then of course compassionate politics looks Pollyanna-ish.
So what changed in our society then that we once found a cohesive welfare state appealing and now we don't?
Yeah, and when you mention the kind of a welfare state again, you're chastised and stigmatised as some kind of, you know, dinosaur from the past. Mm. And I mean, that's one of the big challenges. How do you make a welfare state where, you know, the needs of the community are met largely by the state and by responsible private sector? How do you make that sort of interesting and sexy again, so that people will feel there's something worth defending and promoting? I mean, when you see the way in which hospitals help the health sector, the welfare sector, the education sector, all being undermined at the moment, I can't see any good coming out of it. And worse, I can see, you know, a deeper polarisation, a deeper division, which will make, you know, peace building in Aotearoa, New Zealand, that much more challenging.
What then do we need to do for future generations?
Well, I think we have to think in terms of, you know, what, you know, my old mate Elise Boulding called a 200-year present. You know, there'll be somebody born today that, you know, that will live for 100 years, and there's somebody alive today who's already lived for 100 years. And we need to kind of learn from that wisdom of the past and make sure that the person that's born today has a reasonable chance of living to 100 years in the future. And that means, you know, not making irreversible decisions, not making policies which, you know, challenge the rights of everybody to enjoy the privileges that we have in terms of, you know, free education and free health, etc., etc.
And what did you call that? A 200-year prison.
200-year prison. So that you, if you put yourself in that, in the middle of that, and then say, well, what wisdom can we learn from the last 100 years, and what do we need to do to make sure that that person born today is going to be able to live a life where they can realize their full potential and be, you know, self-actualized human beings. And I think that's, you know, that's the challenge. So how to make sure that we have a, you know, sustainable economy? How do we make sure that, you know, we always make decisions which are pro-life? And how do we make decisions which ensure that that individual will have a good chance of, you know, at least 3 score years in 10 and a lot more? But in terms of optimism, I mean, that's the biggest challenge, I think. How do we maintain optimism in the face of all the gloom? And one of the things which I was thinking about the other day was that, you know, in the 1960s, and I don't know, I idolised the 1960s, it might have just been because we were raising children or something, but we had a lot more sort of, you know, potluck dinners and a lot more sociability and a lot more sort of meals and things like that with friends. I mean, a lot of us have lost the art of
hospitality.
You know, hospitality. And I think that's one of, you know, and it seems to me that all of us need to know that we're living in a community where we have friends that we can rely on, where our families are protected, where we celebrate conviviality. I mean, and tools for conviviality.
So that in order to be welcoming, we need to practice being
welcoming. We need to be hospitable, and we need to figure out how do we make sure that our, you know, whole society is hospitable to, you know, those who have, you know, are on the, you know, on the poorer side of the spectrum, and those who are, how do we ensure that those who are on the wealthier side of the spectrum do their bit to help the others? I mean, so, and it has got something to do with friendship and hospitality and community and building relationships which are not only self-sustaining but which sustain everybody as they go through, you know, life cycles of hopefulness and challenge.
A friend of mine has a saying that the first rule of being friends is being friendly.
Yes. Well, and that's it, and that's the other thing which I think is under challenge at the moment. How can we be friendly when there's so much that's, you know, just is tearing us apart in the other direction? I don't know if you heard it. There was a BBC report yesterday on the uncovering of an animal torture ring in Indonesia, and this ring, they were torturing animals for the sadistic indulgence of people all around the world.
And you mean filming it?
Filming it and live streaming it. I have no idea. I just
even the fact that there's a market for that.
The fact, yes, and including in New Zealand. I mean, so that, you know, what is it when people can sit in front of a television set and watch somebody dismantle a cat in front of you? It was, you know, just sort of nightmarish. And then you think to yourself, well, this, you know, what does that person, how does that person approach something like friendliness and relationship and understanding, you know, the centrality of, you know, hospitality and friendship? I mean, when, you know, they're not willing to do that for animals or children or whoever else is kind of suffering in these sorts of environments.
Mm. And what hope does the planet have if we can't be kind to a cat?
Exactly, yes, and dogs and others. I mean, I just don't get it. And I mean, the biggest challenge, I mean, in all of what you've been talking about is, I mean, how do we deal with despair and desperation? And I think we need to surround ourselves with people that are optimistic and cheerful. I mean, that's, you know, don't underestimate the power of a cheer germ.
It's a big responsibility, isn't it?
It's a big responsibility.
People who offer a bit of instant joy.
It's instant joy. That's exactly what it is. And they're really crucial people, and they're at a premium at the moment. And you look at kind of comedians, and comedians are sort of sick and kind of are perpetuating...
It's a comedy of cruelty.
It's a comedy of cruelty. And so we need people that are really capable of enlivening us in different ways. And even if they're tame jokes, coming up with good jokes that are not at the expense of others, but which somehow or other give us the courage to keep on going on.
We have to end this on some positivity.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, in your life right now, you're talking about instant joy. What's the thing that you do that makes you instantly cheerful?
Well, it sounds really pathetic, but when our golden retriever dog looks at me with two brown eyes and expects me to kind of, you know, drop a treat in her direction,
mm-hmm.
or alternatively goes around and you know, smells the world, sees the world through her nose. I mean, that gives me a kind of a certain immediate cheerfulness. I mean, it's, you know, in fact, I had to write something on the state of the world the other day, and I was sitting down with the dog, and I said, "What do you think about the state of the world?" And of course, the dog looks in a kind of bemused fashion, and I thought, "Well, that's fair
me
enough."
Too.
Me too. It's come to that. I mean, but.
That's a good example, though.
It is a good example. You know, just catching up with old friends is, you know, is in itself.
I like the idea that good humour is like I don't mean an antidote, because you mean it's kind of preventative.
Yeah.
But that stops us from becoming too cruel and unfeeling.
Yes.
If we practice good humour, being good humoured and.
Yes, and that would have an immediate effect on people around us.
It's very chastising, though. It makes me feel like my grumpiness has been
contributing to all this. But everybody knows your grumpiness is really a front for kind of, you know, kindness and patience and things like that.
And that was Kevin Clements talking about peace, social justice, and how to be hopeful in difficult times. Thank you for listening to the Tui Motu podcast. For information about the magazine and subscriptions, go to www.tuimotu.org.